beg our trainer, Jim Ramsey, for a bottle of Vicodin, and he gives me 2 tablets. I look at him in disbelief. That's not even going to get me out of the building. Through my nagging, and I mean a lot of nagging, he eventually doled out some more. Years later, the issue of prescription overdoses has become a hot topic because the number of deaths happening to former players has increased tremendously. And that's because so many guys have become addicted to opioids. I think it's because the players are all much bigger, faster, and stronger as a result of superior nutrition, superior genetics, and the supplements and training programs we use. This is topped off by the protective gear we wear, which is like a weapon in itself when you're moving at speed. I mean, getting the hard plastic of an elbow pad in the face can easily knock you out. And yet our brains are still the same size, and the organs inside our bodies are the same size as they were in 1875, when hockey first started to be played indoors. The difference is that the impact and forced trauma in today's game is exponentially greater. In the old days, a player could drink a bottle of Jim Beam to numb the pain, but not now. You need drugs. And the more you need, the more tolerance to them you develop, and the worse the injuries become. So all this adds up to why the rate of serious injury to athletes has risen. And the only way you can fix this problem is to change the rules of the game, which have to evolve with technology. Otherwise, technology is going to kill sports. But instead, we blame the trainers. How is a trainer supposed to say no to my request for pain pills when I'm lying on the floor of a dirty locker room, dry heaving because my shoulder hurts so much? So the trainer gives the player the drugs he's asking for so that he can get through the game and go back out to sacrifice his body for himself, his family, and the fans of the city he loves. I missed 18 games with that shoulder injury, which is my longest NHL injury to date. Being injured puts you in a very lonely place as a professional athlete. You see the injured players at practice, watching the guys play the game they cannot play for the time being, and sometimes they come on road trips, though they usually stay behind. Sometimes the healthy players start to resent them. This fucking guy doesn't miss a paycheck and he gets to enjoy his family time while I play 16 games in 30 days. It's a natural feeling for players to have. And it gets really bad if the injured player's teammates don't think he's working as hard at rehab as he should. Because statistics are the barometer to measure how an NHL player gets paid, it's human nature for players to work the system. Let's say a guy has a great first half of the season. In 40 games, he scores 16 goals and adds 34 assists for a nice 50-point total at a time of the season when it's always easier to come by points because you're not banged up or worn down. But then, from games 41 to 69, his production drops. And when he gets hurt in game 70, his stat is 1.4 points per game. He would be smart to milk his injury to the end of the season so that he'll finish with the higher points per game total. That way, when contract negotiations start in the offseason, his agent has better bargaining power. You would be surprised how often this happens, and although athletes are not usually great with math, we understand the angles you need in negotiations. We call players who milk their injuries band-aids. It's the end of November, and Shanny takes a slap shot and hits me in the left hand in a game against Dallas, and I'm out again. I'm acting like a real baby because I feel like Shanny should have scored on some passes I've given him the last 5 games, and I've told him so. The guy has 15 years on me in the NHL, and he knows the long-term rhythm of the game much better than I do. But even so, I share my opinion that he should be working harder. Then I don't speak to him for a week. Even though Shanny is not pissed at me, this bad bounce has now led to me being injured. It was an honest mistake, and hockey players would never blame another teammate for a bad bounce. But still, I'm annoyed by it all. I've also had problems with this left wrist ever since I had a fight with Darcy Tucker earlier in November. And to be honest, it bothered me last year. So maybe Shanny has done me a favor. They tell me I won't be out long, and as I don't want to do any more damage, I decide to go for the surgery. Because of all the credit I received after the trade last year for turning the team around, and because this season the Rangers are 9-4-1 with me in the lineup and 4-5-1 without me, that evil little thing called human nature pokes his head out again. When a player is out of the lineup, he wants the team to win 60% of the time and lose 40% of the time. Nobody has the balls to say this except me, but it's true, and it's because when a hockey player is injured, his self-worth is low. He doesn't feel wanted or needed because the team's mentality is, we need to push ahead with whatever we have. The only thing that keeps the injured player from going insane is to have his team lose so that he feels wanted. It's just human nature. Even so, good teammates who are out because of injury want their team to win more than they want to see it lose. These thoughts don't consume me since I'm working my ass off to get back into the lineup because my drug is the jersey. My drug is MSG. My drug is New York. The day after Christmas, we're playing against Carolina, and I get a bogus call for interference in front of the net when I tap a Carolina D-man stick out of the way so that it doesn't deflect a puck into my face. There's a scrum, someone takes a punch at me, and then Andrew Ladd is after me. But the linesmen have him, and they have me too. Even so, I get a good right hand in. I'm being careful with my left, and break the orbital bone in his left eye. You never want to injure another player, but that's what's going to happen until they change the rules. I get tossed from the game, but we win 5-2. I loved, 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 loved getting in on a hard forecheck. I would time my arrival to hit the defenseman just as he's about to touch the puck to try to get it the hell out of his zone, while I'm careering in at him full speed and looking to tattoo him into the end boards. I also love to taunt defensemen on faceoffs, so they know that no matter how quickly they think they can play the puck out of their zone, I'm still going to hit them hard. It's similar to defensive linemen talking to the quarterback before every snap in football, announcing their imminent plans to make him part of the turf. Tonight it's March 10th, and we're in Buffalo. Once again, as the playoffs loom, it's a tight squeeze in the standings among a bunch of clubs. We're comfortably in the middle of the playoff-bound teams at the moment, with 81 points, but the Sabres have 74 and are, at this moment, out of a playoff spot. We're almost halfway through the second period with the game tied at 1 when I'm racing for the puck with Buffalo D-man Nathan Paich. It's been dumped around the end boards from left to right, and I hit him with perfect timing, and he flies from the goal line to the backboards, and I think he's dead. The puck goes bang-bang off the boards and ends up on my stick behind the net. I put a perfect backhand pass onto the stick of number 68, and Jaromir Jagr buries it in the back of the net. It was the best body check of my career. We won 3-2 in a shootout. On March 29th, 2008, I was feeling pretty great. My body had healed from injury and surgery, and we were in a much better place in the standings than we had been this time last year. I was looking forward to the playoffs. We had a practice that morning, and when I stepped out of the elevator and saw the look on the face of my doorman, I knew something was wrong. Usually, if I was on page 6 of the New York Post, he would say, "Don't worry, big guy. Page 6 just showing you love this morning," in his heavy Queens accent. But today, he just handed me the Daily News, and I almost shit my pants. My knees gave out, and I had to lean up against the desk in the front lobby of my 19th Street apartment building, for there was my picture, in a Rangers uniform under the headline, "The Ranger and the Madam." Rangers hockey star Sean Avery's name and private cell phone number are in the little black book of Manhattan Madam Kristen Davis, the Daily News crowed. Avery, 27, a trash-talking enforcer who has dated a string of models and actresses, is listed as a $500 client of brothel Maison de l'Amour. Now, if there's one thing that I didn't need to pay for, it was sex. Or let me qualify that. Every man pays for sex somehow, Some with vacations, shoes, dresses, emotional vulnerability. It's called being in a relationship, and those forms of payment are what we all do, one way or another. But paying for a hooker is not my thing. I was shaking for the entire hour and change that it took to drive to the practice rink. And as soon as I arrived, I walked into Glenn Sather's office to apologize and to explain very clearly that I had nothing to do with this. Glenn had his feet up on his desk and was chomping on his customary cigar. He told me with a twinkle in his eye to weather the media storm and it would go away, for there was nothing the New York media liked better than to prove each other wrong. After practice, the reporters and photographers were waiting for me, and I just laughed and said to the cameras, "I can promise you that if I ventured into one of these establishments, I wouldn't use my own name." A couple of days later, my pals at the New York Post came to the rescue. Busty accused Madam Kristen Davis is icing a report that New York Rangers star Sean Avery was a customer of her high-end escort service. I personally spoke to her, and she confirmed that she has never had any contact with Sean Avery in any shape or form, Davis's lawyer Mark J. Heller told the Post yesterday. The Post took delight in saying that I was going to sue the Daily News for hundreds of millions of dollars as I had free agency coming up. But really, I found the fact that I'd wound up and then not wound up in the little black book of a celebrated New York madam to reveal just how much I'd gotten into the imagination of the city. We make the 2008 Stanley Cup playoffs with ease, and our first round opponent is across the Hudson River in New Jersey, which is almost as good as a subway series. It means that I get to sleep in my own bed, and not the one at the brothel, for the entire series, which we'd like to end as quickly as we can. Our record against the Devils this season has been fantastic. We played them 8 times and won 7, with 1 loss in OT, which was our last game against them. While that's not exactly the way you want to go into a playoff series where ties are decided in full overtime periods, we like our chances. The atmosphere in the Prudential Center, this cavern of a new rink in Newark, is hostile. But that's because half the crowd are Devils fans and the other half are Rangers fans. In the last game of the regular season, I was all over Marty Brodeur. This time, my speech to him was easy and true. I was standing on top of the crease telling him what a disgrace he is for falling in love with his sister-in-law. Just so everyone is clear here, he started to fuck around with his wife's brother's wife and eventually left his wife for her sister-in-law. Consider that for a second. You leave your wife, the mother of your kids, for her brother's wife? That's so twisted on so many levels that it makes you dizzy trying to unravel the layers of betrayal. So please tell me where in the Hockey Man rulebook it says that I can't tell this guy he's a fucking dirtbag every time I see him. It's excessive, yes, but we really aren't here to make friends. I want to win the cup, and this guy, no matter what plane of hockey godship people think he lives on, is in my way. A few minutes into the second period, I make a patient, and if I do say so, pretty damn skilled backhand pass to Scott Gomez, who is flying up the middle. He fires a hard pass to Shanahan on the right wing, and vintage Shanny takes 2 steps and fires a laser that slides under Mrs. Brodeur's ex-husband. It's 1-0, and I skate by Marty to remind him that that's my first assist of the series, and I ask what section his fellow home wrecker is sitting in so I can blow her a kiss. He leaves me guessing, the rogue. We're up 2-1 in the third period when Gomez takes a puck over the Devil's blue line and goes wide around both D-men, but runs out of room because Brodeur comes out so far to challenge. At the last second, Gomez looks over his right shoulder and sees me cutting down the middle of the slot. I'm in the sweetest of spots, alone in front of the gaping net, and he lays the puck in the crease for me to pound home. If there was any doubt, Marty knows my name. In game 2, every time I come near Marty's crease, he taps the back of my legs and I lose balance, a few times dangerously close to falling on him. But I do not turn and whack him back. My discipline is spot on during the playoffs, and I really am like a different player. I've grown as a professional, and New York has made it happen. I can just play the game I love and drive my opponent nuts by doing just that. Of course, my reputation precedes me, and I need to be careful not to let Marty suck me into a penalty, especially going into a game tied at zero in the third period. I'm thinking about how I can avoid Marty's little tricks, and then I come up with the solution. Nearly 5 minutes into the third, and 20 seconds after Jágr puts one past Marty and gives us the lead, the puck finds its way to the tip of my blade as I'm standing in the slot. And with a one-timer, I snap it just under the crossbar. The Devils score later in the third, but my goal stands as the game winner. We're going back to MSG, up 2 games to 0, and I already have 2 goals in this series. I'm pretty sure Marty is rattled when he heads home to his sister-in-law. I mean wife. Game 3 is at MSG, and it's a madhouse. Our fans were loud in New Jersey, but in their home barn, they're mighty. Shaking the joint mighty. We're tied at 1, and it's early in the second period when we wind up on a 5-on-3 power play. Jaromír Jágr is on the right point and Shanahan is on the left, with Gomez and Drury each on their respective back doors and me in front. I can't take a penalty here, and I know that the refs would love to call one on us because 5-on-3 is a pretty serious advantage, especially in the playoffs. This means I need to improvise. Hockey is a game of instincts and vision, of being able to stay one step ahead. My job is to scream Brodeur, but he's behind me. Then it hits me. I will simply turn around and face Marty. The moment I put my hands in Marty's face, I realize that this is incredibly smart, as in a moment of genius. Standing the normal way to screen a goalie is ineffective because all the goalie needs to do is look around me, and I don't have eyes in the back of my head to see which way he's looking. I also can't protect myself from his wax to the back of my legs. So I stand facing Marty, and the crowd starts to go crazy. Marty puts his hands up and takes a swipe at my face with his glove hand. So I put all my weight on my heels and lean back to avoid the contact. One of the referees, Don Van Massenhoven, skates inches away from me and tells me to cut the shit out or he's going to give me 2 minutes. A ref skating to a guy standing in front of the net on a 5-on-3 and then talking to him while the play is still alive is unheard of. And he wants to give me a penalty for this. I yell back at him, for what? I'm staring into the whites of Mr. Martin Brodeur's eyes, which are starting to turn as red as the Devil's logo on his chest. Chris Drury skates over now to my left side and sort of whispers in my ear to stop because Van Massenhoven is going to give me 2 minutes, and I still don't know why I would be getting this penalty. All the while, I have two of the hardest shooters in the NHL taking slap shots that could shatter my spine or break my ribs or crack my tailbone and smash up any other bone in my back that I don't know about. So that should put any dumb statements about me doing this for show to rest. I don't get a penalty, and about 15 seconds later, Gomez makes a quick pass to my waiting stick, and I bury it between the legs of Mrs. Brodeur's ex-husband. MSG goes absolutely insane. Nobody has ever seen anything like this, including the NHL. And so the next day, they officially amended the NHL rulebook without consulting the owners or the NHLPA or anyone. They just did it so that I could never do this again, even though nowhere in the rulebook was it illegal. But now it was. I was actually flattered that they called this rulebook rejig the Avery Rule. Colin Campbell, the NHL's director of hockey operations, announced it to the waiting world. An unsportsmanlike conduct minor penalty will be interpreted and applied effective immediately to a situation when an offensive player positions himself facing the opposition goaltender and engages in actions such as waving his arms or stick in front of the goaltender's face for the purpose of improperly interfering with and or distracting the goaltender as opposed to positioning himself to try and make a play. We ended up beating New Jersey in 5 games. And in the traditional handshake line at the end of the series, Marty pulled his hand away as I stuck mine out. The unsportsmanlike gesture just proved what I had been saying about him when I wasn't scoring goals on him. Not a class act, on the ice or off it. We felt very confident going into the semifinals against the Penguins. We'd played them 8 times during the season and had a 5-3 record against them. So we felt more than able to win 4 more games against them now. And then we go and lose the first 2. We need to win the next one at home, or else it's going to be a very steep climb out of the hole. I mean, at this point in NHL history, only 2 teams have come back from being down 3-0 in the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Leafs did it against Detroit in 1942, and the Islanders did it in 1975 against Pittsburgh. Maybe it's an omen. We play Game 3 at MSG, and as ever, our fans are giving us a boost. I'm skating full speed on the offensive zone forecheck and have my target locked in. It's Hal Gill, the Penguins' 6'7", 250-pound D-man. He actually sees me coming and braces himself. So he steps into the check, and we hit each other straight on, full blast. The wind gets blown out of my chest, and it feels as if I've just torn my abdominals. In the first intermission, I walk into the trainer's room and ask Jim Ramsey and our team doctor, Andy Feldman, to give me the good stuff, more Toradol. I play the rest of the game and get an assist in the second period, but we can't beat the Penguins, and now we're down 3-0. After the game, I'm exhausted. I can hardly pick my head up, and all I can think about is getting into the cold tub. About a minute into my cold tub session, it feels as if someone just came up behind me and stabbed me in the shoulder. I call Dr. Feldman over and tell him what's going on, and he immediately tells me to get dressed. We're going to the hospital. I feel so weak walking into St. Vincent's in Greenwich Village that they immediately run a CT scan and MRI. While we're waiting for the doctors to read the tests, the pain gets really bad, so they hit me with the Dilaudid, which is a morphine derivative that treats moderate to severe pain. It doesn't sit well, so I start projectile vomiting. This was a blessing in disguise because now I'm puking blood, and the room looks like I've just committed mass murder. I'm covered in blood too, and the doctors know now I'm bleeding internally. It turned out that my collision with Hal Gill had lacerated my spleen, and I spent the next 5 days in a room in the basement of St. Vincent's. The only way they can find the laceration is by hoping that it pops its head out and sprays my insides with blood while they have the scope inside me. And after a few tries, they finally found it. I would live to fight another day, but my season was done. The next morning, James Dolan, the owner of the Rangers, and Glenn Sather, the GM, came to see me. My close friend Lauren Flynn was asleep on a chair in the corner of the room, and Lauren had brought our mutual friend May Anderson along. May is Danish and a world-famous model. I was in a ton of pain during the night, and the ladies took turns giving me ice chips because I'd never been so thirsty in my life, but every time I drank something, I'd throw it up, which in turn would make me even thirstier. May fell asleep in the fetal position at the bottom of my bed, and the night nurse had put blankets over her, so at first glance you couldn't even tell she was there. The look on the faces of Slats and Mr. Dolan when they walked into the room and May popped her head out from under the sheets was legendary. I mean, you couldn't have staged it better. And now I realize it also really hurt to laugh. Chapter 17, The Summer of Vogue. While sitting in my hotel room between games 3 and 4 against New Jersey, I wrote a letter to the woman I'd called Mrs. Bloomberg when I first met her at the Met Ball, asking the celebrated Anna Wintour of Vogue if I could be an intern during my upcoming off-season. I had started reading Vogue in LA and dove deeper into the fashion world after I moved to New York City, just really by paying attention to all the amazing ways people put themselves together in this city. And I still read Vogue and GQ and anything really that would help me understand what I was seeing. My personal style has always been important to me, starting with my first pair of Nike sneakers, which I got on my 9th birthday. I'd coveted those shoes as soon as I'd first seen them. At looking back how important they were, I regret not keeping them as a memento. Air Pegasus, 1989. I remember my first t-shirt from Chip and Pepper, and I also remember the first time I met Pepper at a house party in L.A., after I'd given his wife a cigarette and started to inappropriately vibe with her, not knowing she was married and certainly not to my favorite clothing designer and maker. I started to read Vogue for a few reasons. I was actually into the storytelling, as the magazine isn't just pages of glossy paper with pictures of pretty women in expensive clothes. I realized this when I opened a story shop by Annie Leibovitz, and although I didn't read books that often as a child, flipping through the pages of this story engaged me, and I wanted to know what happened next. It was a magical story being told with clothes and a supermodel. It was visual art. I also used Vogue as a kind of social media tool. I was tired of the conversations that had surrounded me for the last 8 years in NHL locker rooms, ones that would usually consist of cars, pussy, food, drugs, money, watches, and more money. So I carried my monthly copy of Vogue onto the team plane tucked under my arm, with the cover very visible, as a sort of subtle fuck you to my immediate society. The circles in which I was socializing in New York were much different from the ones in Los Angeles. In New York, people talk about interesting things. And in those conversations, because I didn't feel as worldly, I needed something to separate me even more. What better way to do that than to learn everything I could about fashion? I could walk into a party and tell a woman exactly who made her bag and what season it was first shown in. I was blowing people away, especially the gay guys. And as soon as you get the gay vote, you have a shot at any woman in the room. Which is not why I was doing it, but it didn't hurt. And yes, meeting babes was also part of the reason for sending my letter to Anna Wintour, though my love of fashion was the prime mover. I heard back from her through the proper channels, and once I'd recovered from my lacerated spleen, I was to go through Vogue's version of training camp, a series of meetings with different people at the magazine to see if I was worthy and why I wanted to do this. I didn't blame them for wanting to test me, and because I was the first athlete to try to do this, everyone needed to make sure that I was sincere. I met Lori Jones in her office at Four Times Square. Lori was Vogue's managing editor and had also spent 20 years at New York Magazine. She's this tough Texan with an acute bullshit meter. I explained to her that I really loved fashion and wanted to understand it more and to learn about the business from the inside. I promised that I'd do all the same stuff as the regular interns, showing up on time Monday through Friday and working as long as I had to in order to do whatever they wanted. I would make minimum wage and check in with her each week to tell her what I'd done. Miss Jones seemed satisfied by what I had to say, and so she picked up the phone and called Sally Singer, who was a senior editor, and asked if she was ready for me. Sally was softer than Lori, and my intimidation was quashed the moment I walked into her office. She explained that she wanted me to shadow specific editors. We agreed that I'd have a 30-day internship and that it would start on Monday at 9 a.m. I was as excited as if I'd just made the team after a tough camp, the difference being that the team would give me a uniform. Now I had to figure out what I was going to wear at my first day at Vogue. When I walked into the office that Monday morning in May at 9 a.m. sharp with a tea in one hand and the New York Post in the other, I could feel all eyes on me and everyone asking the same question. What the hell is this New York Ranger doing at Vogue? There was confusion and interest and excitement rippling through the halls at Four Times Square, and I felt it too, like you do when you join a new team. Will I fit in? Will I be able to pull this off? But the added twist is that, while I know how to play hockey, I've never played on a world-class fashion team. One thing that I'd have to pull off better was my own fashion sense. For my first day at Vogue, I wore slacks, a check shirt, and a patterned tie. I mean, the checks and pattern did not go together, and all the Vogue people knew that, and soon enough, I would too. My first mission is to take care of the closet, which does not look like the one in the movies, but its function is the same. It's the fashion nerve center of the place, a small office with minimal shelving crammed with garment racks of clothes and shoes everywhere. I'm helping to organize it with two other interns known as Voguettes. Voguettes are the interns tasked with carrying clothes across the city and around the globe so that the well-traveled editors have all the tools to create stories and images that will command millions in advertising dollars. Voguettes are usually from wealthy families, but they're hardworking and cute, never hot, but always cute. They're well-read and have great manners and have chosen to sacrifice their social lives, love lives, and family lives so that they can be a part of the magazine they've dreamed of working for since they were teenagers. I found it fascinating to see the dedication the staffers at Vogue have. These women work for low wages and they put in grueling 70-hour weeks. Let me tell you, most men could not finish 1 week at four Times Square. The gossip buzzed through the building on my first day, with people wondering if I was leaving pro hockey for fashion or if I was part of some elaborate reality TV prank. At lunch, I further confused everyone by heading to the cafeteria and filling my plate with a mountain of food, which stood in stark contrast to the meager salads consumed by the girls of Glamour, Teen Vogue, Men's Vogue, Self, other magazines in the building. I couldn't have been happier. Back home in Pickering, my mother Marlene was proud of my detour from the predictable pro hockey player summer path, though my father Al was a little bit surprised by it. He took a ribbing from his golf buddies about me, the tough NHL agitator now swishing through the corridors of fashion. Though he's a man of few words with me, he did ask me if I was trying to tell him I was gay. I laughed and told him it was exactly the opposite. I'd found a summer gig doing something I loved in a workplace filled with beautiful women where I was the only straight guy. He smiled. He got it. A black town car picked me up one morning at 6 o'clock from my place on West 19th Street, and 45 minutes later, I was on the set of my first Vogue shoot. The only time I'd been on the set of a photo shoot before was when I was playing in LA. I was the subject, and the great Bruce Weber shot me for Vanity Fair. For my Vanity Fair shoot, I flew to Florida, and we did some shots in a hockey rink in suburban Miami. And then we went back to Bruce's home on Ocean Boulevard in Hollywood, Florida, which is easily the coolest house I've ever seen. It's a one-story modern masterpiece with a glass wall that opens up to connect the inside of the house to the white sand beaches outside. Bruce had me eating out of the palm of his hand, posing in my tidy whiteies on the beach and in the pool, surrounded by more golden retrievers than people. It hit me that all his photo assistants looked like college football quarterbacks, sculpted from granite, tanned, and not wearing all that much. I leaned into my publicist, Nicole, and said, "Are you seeing what I'm seeing?" By the size of the smile on her face, I guess she did. I mean, I've been in locker rooms with 20 naked guys watching two naked guys wrestle, and nobody for a minute thought it was gay. Because your life as a pro athlete means that you're always surrounded by athletic guys in various states of undress. The Bruce Weber shoot just seemed like a locker room. Until the moment I realized that I might be the only straight guy on set. No one hit on me or anything, but it was a funny realization because sometimes, if you're not looking, you can't see the obvious. Today's photo shoot for Vogue has nothing to do with me in my underwear and everything to do with Narciso Rodriguez, a veteran designer favored by A-list celebrities and, more importantly, by the editors of Vogue. We're shooting at a beach club on Long Island, which looks like it hasn't had a coat of fresh paint in half a century. Raquel Zimmerman, a Brazilian goddess, is the supermodel of the day, and I study her up close. She's a perfectly proportioned 5'10", with long, sculpted legs and perfect breasts and shoulders like a world-class swimmer, and long, curly blonde hair. She's perfection when it comes to beauty, and she becomes even more beautiful when seen through the eye of a lens. Claire Danes is also in the shoot. She's a complicated soul, which makes her a true talent on screen and stage, and while she does not have the body of a supermodel, she still captures the camera's fickle eye with her pouty, intense, intelligent seduction. I try to stay focused and perform the odd jobs I'm assigned, such as helping the catering crew find a table to set up lunch and picking up garbage to keep the set tidy. Everyone from Claire to Raquel to the stylist is confused by my presence. I'm wearing black shorts, a black t-shirt, and black desert boots. And I have a 25K Rolex on my wrist and look like I should be playing hockey. But I'm an intern at Vogue. I soon made a fashion statement of my own. Because the heat and humidity make NYC a hot and swampy mess in spring and summer, I had my tailor turn the pants of my suit into shorts, and I wear them along with the suit jacket over a white dress shirt. I beat the heat and still look great doing it. As I walk into 4 Times Square, almost every single person who passes by me does a double take, and by lunchtime, the cafeteria is buzzing with talk of my suit. I had men from all the different magazines coming up and complimenting me on my idea and asking if I think they can pull it off. You could pull off anything if you're confident, except maybe a checked shirt and patterned tie. Actually, my most embarrassing moment at Vogue came in the cafeteria, too. As I walk toward the checkout with 2 plates of beef stroganoff, salad, bottles of water, and Jell-O for dessert, I noticed Hamish Bowles out of the corner of my eye. Hamish is an extremely dandy fashion man and one of the most powerful people at Vogue. While noticing him, I didn't realize that the wet floor sign was placed right below my feet. When I did, my natural instinct was to avoid it, and I slipped. And so I watched in the slowest of slow motion, my tray of food land a foot in front of me and ranch dressing paint the front of my black t-shirt and vest. The worst part was that when I stood up and gave a bow, which would usually be followed by a round of applause at MSG, I was met by a very deafening silence. Vogue editors are in charge of overseeing the stories that fill the pages of each month's issue. They are often women from affluent families who went to private schools in Connecticut and then to Ivy League colleges. A lot of them have husbands in private equity and they summer in the Hamptons. They run themselves ragged and are truly slaves to fashion and sustain themselves with Marlboro Reds and green juice. They're very talented, but they must please the queen herself, Anna Wintour, whom some underlings have called Nuclear Winter due to her icy personality. The Devil Wears Prada was a very successful novel and movie based on the life of an Anna Wintour assistant who was tasked with impossible jobs like securing an advanced copy of the latest Harry Potter. These assistants aspired to become Vogue editor someday as well. And one of the unbelievable perks that came with an internship was sitting in on editorial meetings where all the editors would update Anna on new ideas for next month's issue and review pictures from the most recent shoots. Everyone was nervous in these meetings in which Anna would sit at the head of the table with her sunglasses on and a cup of Starbucks in her hand. One of her 2 assistants would be taking notes, and I'd sit in a chair off to the side, trying to control my sweating so it wasn't obvious how nervous I was. I can't remember anything specific that was reviewed during my time there because all I could think about was whether Anna was sizing me up behind her shades. When she didn't like a picture or idea, she would sit in silence, and the editor presenting it would disappear through a hole in the floor. Not really, but they probably wanted to. And then Anna would immediately move on to the next idea. It was a tense room, but it was very effective in getting the edition sorted out. There was no debating back and forth. You just kept moving forward until the boss was satisfied because hers was the only opinion that mattered. One of the legendary editors at Vogue was André Léon Talley, who had worked under Anna Wintour since 1983 and was one of the few gay African-American men in such an influential position. After I had written my letter to Anna Wintour, I invited him to come see us in a playoff game against Pittsburgh, and he agreed. I was to arrange everything with his assistant. I was shocked when the assistant informed me that I'd need to send a car to Tally's home in Westchester, which would drive him to the game, take him to dinner after the game, and then drive him home. This was years before Uber existed, and I knew this adventure would easily set me back $1,000. After our warm-up, the Rangers media man Jason Vogel grabbed me outside the locker room with a look of panic in his eyes. "We have a problem," he said. "Your friend Andre can't fit in the seat." Andre was 6'6", and though Anna Wintour had initiated an intervention about the man's weight in 2005, 3 years later, he was still pretty substantial. I'd wondered if we'd have to seat him in the penalty box, because there was certainly room for him there. Jason was one step ahead of me, though, and had already put Andre in a plush fold-out chair in the handicap section of MSG, which was actually one of the best seats in the house. The sight of this gigantic black man in a full-length fur coat, sitting alone in majestic splendor, was not hard to miss from the ice level, and it had the guys laughing every time they looked up into that section. It was as if some exotic African royalty had come to MSG to bestow his blessing upon the blue shirts, but he seemed to be enjoying the spectacle of which he was part. After the game, we'd made plans to go to dinner at the Waverly Inn, which was the hottest restaurant in NYC. I didn't dare make Andre wait around while I did media and showered, and had the car take him to the restaurant immediately after the final buzzer. When I walked into the Waverly, Karl Lagerfeld, the most famous fashion designer in the world, was at our table. It's always hard to stop sweating after a game, even when you've showered and changed. And once I saw Karl, dressed as always, as if he was mashing up an 18th century tableau with a vampire movie, high collars and sunglasses, my nerves went into high gear and I was dripping away. I didn't say much and listened hard, but Carl's thick German-French accent and the speed with which he spoke made it almost impossible for me to understand him when meeting for the first time. During that dinner, I saw a lot of people whom I knew socially, and the cool ones just gave me a nod and kept walking. There were a few who wanted to stop and talk, and so to avoid disrupting my dinner companions, I'd get up from the table to speak to them. I had no idea that this is apparently hitting the absolute bottom in table manners, and the next morning I get word that Andre is beyond furious with me and can't believe I would get up from the table while he was there. Apparently I was supposed to ignore everyone who tried to say hello to me, because who could be more interesting or powerful than the people at the table? So ignoring your other friends is considered polite in the fashion world. One day during my internship, I was asked to go to LA to help an editor named Catherine McNeil with a few different shoots she had. And this task filled me with pleasure and a little worry, as I was flying back to the city I'd loved once and then left, in my new incarnation as a New York Ranger fashionista. The Black Eyed Peas are one of the biggest pop bands in the world, and Vogue was shooting them. They were using an LA-based crew and stylist assistants, and I didn't know anyone on set, but I could feel that everyone was confused by my presence. It's not like everyone stops and introduces themselves at the beginning, just like they didn't on every NHL team I played for except the Rangers. And there are a lot of fast-moving parts. Everything was running smoothly until Will.i.am started to give Catherine a hard time about the clothes options. He didn't want to wear anything that Vogue wanted him to wear and insisted on wearing his own clothes. He was being difficult as they did a light test and eventually walked off the set with his publicist, leaving Catherine in tears. As he walked towards me, I rose out of the shadows and stepped in front of him. "You don't know me," I began, "but my advice would be to think twice about walking out of a Vogue shoot that has you starring in it. And you can also break the news to Fergie that her Vogue shoot won't be happening." He didn't say anything. He just looked confused, and his publicist tried to move them along. I wasn't budging, and Will.i.am could see that. Once word gets out that you bailed, you will have more than problems from Vogue, and in my humble opinion, I don't think that's something you want. I wasn't trash-talking him, but I used the same sense of authority that I used when getting into someone's head on the ice, and now he looked worried. I stepped out of the way, and he and his publicist walked past, with the publicist giving me the death stare. It was an interesting lesson for me. When a celebrity acts like they're a celebrity, all of a sudden they lose that power of seduction. It was certainly the first time a Vogue intern had stepped into an NHL enforcer's role on a photo shoot, but it worked. Will.i.am came back to Earth from his lofty perch in the stars, and we made it through. After that, I could do no wrong in Catherine's eyes. As I said earlier, part of the reason I did this internship was to meet some babes and, ideally, one of the ladies being shot for the magazine. Walking through the halls of Vogue was always an adventure, and because I was one of the few straight men in the office, I think I was the object of the odd crush. I liked this attention, and would go out of my way to do little things like buying the girls lunch in the cafeteria, or ordering a town car for them when I overheard a summons to head downtown with those dreaded black garment bags. Anytime you see a pretty girl carrying a black garment bag in NYC, you know she's an intern for a fashion magazine. I really tried to behave myself while I worked 1 month as an intern, since I was representing not only Vogue while on set or in the studio, but also the New York Rangers. The one big difference between the NHL and the fashion world is the lack of rules. When it came to sex, drugs, music, opinions, the fashion world didn't really have any rules, as long as what you were doing or saying had style. I loved it. Stephen Klein is one of the most famous fashion photographers in the world, and today he is shooting a story for Vogue. I'm on set not because I'm needed there, but because I want to see the great Stephen Klein work, and this is another perk when you're a famous intern. As they fixed a light during the third look of the day, Stephen Klein suddenly stopped in the middle of a conversation he was having with two models and just stared at me. He stared for quite a while and then leaned into the girls and whispered something to them. 4 hours later, I was behind the wheel of my Audi waiting for the incredibly sexy model who'd been at Stephen Klein's side for most of the day. After Stephen whispered whatever he said about me to her, she too suddenly couldn't stop staring at me. And after lunch, while we were both sneaking a cigarette, we agreed to an early Friday evening dinner at the Mercer after the shoot wrapped. By Sunday morning, I was finally back home after a weekend with her, one which took a turn for the better around 1 p.m. on a Friday, all because of a whisper and a look. Someday, I'm going to open a small cafe in Soho and call it A Whisper and a Look. It will definitely sell copies of Vogue. July 1st is about a week away, and that's the day I become an unrestricted free agent, which means that if I don't sign with the Rangers before then, I can sign with any team in the league. Nothing is going on with New York, who have put a lowball offer on the table, and the mix of my emotions is intense. At one moment, I'm angry at the offer from the Rangers. I almost died for this team just a few months ago, and the arena chants my name on a regular basis, and the damn team has won with me in the lineup and lost when I'm not there. I also had the stats over the last 2 years to get paid more than the $2.5 million a year that the Rangers want to pay me. Pat Morris, my agent, said he was going to get me the most money that he could, and then I could decide on my next NHL jersey. Pat felt Glenn made that below-market offer because he didn't believe that I would leave. Was he right? Running through me is a cocktail of excitement and dread, because I'm about to make more money than I ever dreamed of making. But I know that it's going to be somewhere other than New York. It would mean leaving the one place I finally felt was home, the place where all my hard work was finally being respected and rewarded. Or was it? One night during the negotiations, my close friend Matt Abramchik, at that time the owner of the Beatrice, came by my apartment and said he wanted to go for a ride to Tribeca. So we jumped in his Range Rover and headed downtown. You can feel the energy shift when you cross over Canal Street into Tribeca, the triangle below Canal. It has cobblestone streets and beautiful lofts, but it's still pretty empty in Tribeca in the summer of 2008. We pull up in front of 77 Warren, a Vietnamese restaurant that's now gone out of business and where, rather sadly, the tables are still set. It was a total surprise because Matt had said nothing about going to check out a potential restaurant. The moment I walked inside, I saw exactly what Matt saw. With its brick walls and battered hardwood floors, we could turn this place into a non-sports bar sports bar. The Rangers locker room, circa 1968. Matt and I had kicked around the idea of opening up a bar or eatery together during some of our late nights at the Beatrice. And because of the uncertainty of my NHL future, I'm looking for ways to anchor myself in this city I love. And seeing this place made me realize that the time had come. I was about to get into the hospitality business. Around the same time, I'd also started to hang out with this beautiful model whom I'd noticed during the off-season a few years back while we were both working out at Equinox West Hollywood, which is full of buff and tanned LA girls. You would never see a look like this woman had, which was a mix of natural beauty and grunge. When we met again in New York, Newt Sear and I had a connection that had been brewing for years. Newt was from Squamish, British Columbia. On July 25th, I landed in Vancouver with Newt, and we headed up the majestic Sea to Sky Highway, past her hometown and onward to the ski resort of Whistler. We were going to attend the first ever Pemberton Music Festival. To get there, we took a helicopter from Whistler to Pemberton. It's about a 17-minute flight. And flying over those snow-capped coast mountains, emerald lakes, and incredibly dense and powerful forests made me feel humbled. It was the perfect place to be at that moment, suspended above paradise, just as I was suspended between NHL teams, awaiting my professional fate. The festival was held around the base of Mount Currie, elevation 8,500 feet. And as we descended in the chopper, we could see the festival below, with cars on the narrow highway backed up for hours, trying to get in. We landed in the backyard of a ski chalet across the street from the festival, which had been set up as a party house for the bands to hang out in, so it was stocked with drinks and food and spots to relax in splendor. I was now used to first-class treatments at festivals, partly because I'd started attending them at the beginning of the push with Bonnaroo and Coachella. But now I was here with a supermodel and we were in our home country of Canada, and I was starting to become very well known in the land that gave the world hockey. This weekend was another piece in the creation of my character in the NHL. The legend of Sean Avery was becoming stronger in a league that very much discouraged individuality. At Pemberton, I'm surrounded by 20,000 drunk Canadians, and half of them seem to have an opinion of me, the calm intake being something like, "There's that crazy fucker Sean Avery." Soon enough, they'd be calling me a motherfucker. The music was excellent. The Tragically Hip were there along with about 50 other bands, and I ended up having an incredible weekend, watching Newt dance like the true hippie she is, and watching a barefoot Jordan Tutu drink more beer than I thought was humanly possible. Tutu was there with his former Nashville teammate Scotty Upshaw. This was the first time I'd ever met either of them off the ice, and they were great guys. I became friends with Scotty because of our mutual love of music. Tutu vanished from the party scene once he got sober, and I'm glad he came out okay on the other side. And then the festival was over, and I was flying back to New York. I had this feeling on the plane that I couldn't shake, that I'd soon be on another plane taking me away from the city I loved. Chapter 18. Sean Does Dallas. I knew I was going to be moving when a call came in from Pat Morris. The Chicago Blackhawks and Dallas Stars were the front runners for my services, Now that the Rangers no longer seem to think I brought value. Or at least, less value than they were willing to pay for. As I said, they had a strange attitude toward money and me, happily shelling out for guys who brought much less to the team than I did, and yet always grinding me. I still don't understand why. My pal Brett Hall is the co-GM in Dallas, and we have a relationship that goes back to Detroit. I mean, I lived in his house and drove him to practice, and my friends nearly killed him with their dope cookies. Brett knows how effective I can be on the ice and off it. He tells me that Dallas is committed to winning and is going to spend some money to do that. Hully told me that I would like Dallas. Good people, fun town, which is all true. It just wouldn't end up being my type of fun. The one thing that neither of us knew was just how deeply ingrained in NYC I had become. Dallas won me over with a 4-year, $15.5 million offer, and for that, I was happy to move to the Lone Star State, though not in much of a rush, as I actually delayed the press conference introducing me as a Dallas Star for 2 days because I was apparently doing something more important in New York. So important, I can't even remember. The congratulatory calls start to flood in, and although I was extremely happy that I'd finally been recognized by a hockey team, which had made a pretty clear statement about how much they wanted me, I also knew that the team in the place I called home didn't want me as badly. I did the appropriate dance with the media and gave the standard bullshit lines about signing with a contender and Dallas being a great hockey town, but I knew that it wasn't. Dallas is the land of the Cowboys, and even after the Maverick owner, Mark Cuban, brought an NBA championship to the city, it was still a football town and a Friday Night Lights state. I remember telling my friends that I couldn't wait to get a big house with lots of bedrooms for everyone to visit. But in truth, I was thinking about how many days I had left in NYC before I needed to pack up and head to Texas. When I finally made it to Dallas for the press conference, I planned on doing everything, including finding a place to live in 2 days. I needed to get back to New York already. After going to see a third rental property in Dallas, I couldn't handle seeing another home filled with pink-themed children's rooms and country-style kitchens. So I found a concrete building near the American Airlines Center that was filled with New York-style lofts. I can get a 5-bedroom, 4,500-square-foot apartment with concrete-polished floors for $3,000 a month, which is about $17,000 cheaper than I'd pay for it in downtown Manhattan. I sign the lease and head directly to the airport to fly back to New York. I'm not as happy as I thought I would be after this money dream came true. NHL training camp for the 2008-2009 season opens on September 15th, which means players arrive in town the day after Labor Day. I'm having a hard time booking my flight and getting on the plane, but I finally do it on September 9th, and I'm one of the last guys to arrive in Dallas, which doesn't look good, especially after the large financial vote of confidence Hully has given me. Everything is different in Dallas. New York is hot in the summer and even has a neighborhood called Hell's Kitchen, so named because of ancient bigotry, but I like to think of it as being because of climate change. But here in the middle of September, Dallas feels like hell's furnace. Everyone drives everywhere, and Mexican is the food of choice. I love Mexican food, but not 3 times a day. Dallas people love their guns and do not love gays. Dallas people love to drink booze, and they take it a bit too far, and I've seen a lot of far, so am in a position to judge. The women of Dallas are also remarkable, redefining the notion of casual. A Dallas belle at a football game means fully done hair and makeup, but replace the high heel with a flat and the denim blouse with a Texas Tech sweatshirt. I can't really tell what these ladies look like because in public, they have on more war paint than Mel Gibson's troops in Braveheart. Putting on and taking off their makeup must add hours to their days. But Dallas, like LA, is about surfaces. Brad Richards moved into my building near the AAC, and from time to time, he'd catch me in my apartment with the lights turned down and some candles burning as I listened to The Best Thing I Found in Dallas by A Texas Mile. A 1970